Hi, everyone. Welcome to the A6&Z podcast. I'm Sonal. Today, we have a unique sort of crossover episode with writer, director, producer Brian Koppelman, who, with his partner David Levine, also wrote some of the most popular and still discussed movies like Ocean's 13 and Rounders, which we'll also touch on in this episode. But currently, Brian is a co-showrunner with David on Billions, which airs on Showtime, and the newest season actually drops this weekend. The reason I'm calling this a sort of crossover episode is that Brian also interviewed Marc Andreessen for his podcast, The Moment, which you can listen to on iTunes and elsewhere if you want to hear more of their thoughts on the difference between a hallucination and vision, putting your art or products and yourself out into the world, and more. We also put the written Q&A version of that conversation up if you want to read it on a6andz.com. But they're two separate conversations, so you don't have to have listened to either to follow both. Today's discussion begins with Marc interviewing Brian, and I jump in between here and there as well, starting with the business of creativity and the creativity of business, then going into how to speak to power, speak to one's team, speak to co-partners, as well as managing the emotions and ego around all that. And finally, ending on some specific moments about Billions the show in the last 10 minutes, where I'll signal a light spoiler alert warning beforehand. We're here to talk about the business and making of film and TV and startups and tech and the parallels and whatnot. Take it from the top, Marc.
Fantastic. So, Brian, thank you for doing this. So I've always been fascinated. I'm deeply fascinated by the process of creative expression and success, in, you know, for sure in technology. And of course, we think of what we do up here as fundamentally trying to find the most creative entrepreneurs and trying to help them build, you know, enormous both creative and professional and business success around what they do. And it struck me for a long time that there are a lot of similarities between how the Valley works and tech works and how entertainment works, film, television, other forms of entertainment works. There's some big similarities. There's also some big differences, which hopefully we'll talk about. You know, guy like you's obviously been super successful across both film and television for a long time, and even before that in music, but I want to focus on film and television. Let's start with this. What was the first project that you, and I think it was you and your partner, David,
yes,
first project that you view that you and David were responsible for creating, selling, and making?
It was Rounders, for which we wrote the screenplay. And today there are people online arguing about that movie, which is incredibly satisfying because, as you know, when you make these bets, it takes a long time to know if you were right very often. And Rounders was rejected. It was incredibly difficult. The movie wasn't a big box office hit. But 21 years later, people are in ferocious online arguments about the most microscopic moments in the film, which I back then, of course, I would have said two things. I would have said we were trying to make a movie like and write a movie that would have the effect on people that movies like Diner had on us, which is that we would watch them over and over again and quote them. And so the fact that happened is really rewarding. And it was kind of in our minds. But when we set out to do that, we knew that there was only a needle in a haystack chance of success. The doing it, we knew right from the beginning, and I think this is something that has been really important to our ability to continue to do this work, David and me, for this long, is from the beginning, it was only about us getting in a room or going separately in our individual rooms before we would come back together and doing the work itself, trusting that if we found a way to do the work itself well enough, some rewards would come. Some have been really delayed rewards and some have been much quicker. We never seem to know which it's going
right.
to be.
So let's start with, for people who haven't, for our listeners who haven't seen Rounders, maybe a thumbnail description of Rounders.
Rounders is a movie set in the poker underground of New York, and Matt Damon and Edward Norton, John Malkovich are the stars of the movie, and John Turturro. And it's about a character who's faced with a life decision, which is he going to pursue his passion, this thing that he believes he's great at, even though he's had setbacks? And in fact, these setbacks have threatened his stable life. And so he's at a point where he has to choose the stable traditional road or the road that his heart is telling him to pursue. And that's the central question. And the movie has a lot of sort of heightened dramatic, you know, you want to choose a heightened dramatic construct in which to hide the theme. Because the last thing you want to do, if you want to talk about the themes, you know, be Eliezer Yudkowsky and just write essays. If you're going to tell it in a fictional construct, make that construct compelling so that only later people wonder and feel what the themes are.
Show versus tell kind of thing.
So when you say you do the work, like what was the do the work part of Rounders for you and David?
First, it was about researching. So I walked into a poker club one night, heard the way the people spoke, saw what it looked like, and immediately recognized nobody's made a movie about this. I can't believe this exists. This should be a movie. I called Dave. he said, well, that's great. Who are the people in the world that we're going to write about? Who are the characters? Who are we going to care about? So we started going to this poker club most every night, taking notes surreptitiously. And then at a certain point, we felt we had enough of those notes. We started really figuring out what the character's question would be, who the character would be, what the important relationships would be in his life. And then we had to, so then we started outlining it, but, and then we had to just decide, okay, starting tomorrow, we're going to meet every morning. One mistake I see people make when they decide they have to do some kind of artistic work is they think it means they have to grab that identity so hard that it has to shut out the rest of their identity. Mm-hmm. But what I found was you don't have to do that. I didn't want to put all the pressure on myself of quitting my job and saying, I need a beret and an easel and I'm an artist.
So what was your job at the time?
I was working as an executive in the music business.
Okay.
David was bartending. Okay. And so what we did was when he would come off bartending, he would sleep a couple hours and I would get up extra early and we would meet in a storage locker underneath my apartment that had a slop sink in it because it was like an institutional little room, had barely room for both of us to sit. I sat on the floor a lot of the time. We met every day for 2 hours in the morning to write the script.
And this is purely on spec?
Completely on spec. In fact, this is, I think, a piece of this puzzle that I never told before, which is that when we had the idea, David met a young producer and told them the idea, and the producer offered us $5,000. Now, and said, for $5,000, I'll be your partner. I'll give you $5,000, but then we're going to share, and if we sell it, we're going to share in your in the writer's fee, and I'm going to be your partner on the thing. And we were tempted because it represented, hey, wait, someone's paying me to write. We're professionals then, right? But we asked some advice of a woman named Rachel Horowitz, who was at Fine Line. She happens to be the sister of Adam Horowitz of the Beastie Boys.
That's awesome.
Rachel was a great executive, and I knew somebody who knew her. And we went and met with her and we said, what should we do? Someone's willing to pay us $5,000. And she said, I don't need to hear the idea, but if someone's willing to pay you guys who have no credits $5,000 now,
right. Write
the thing and you'll have a much better chance of success. And we've taken
fantastic.
That lesson to heart still to this day to write unencumbered. We like to go in a room and let our idea come to fruition fully. Let us work out all the complicated parts of it without outside interference.
So let me ask, because a lot of professional writers, one of the adages I think of professional writers is never write for free. If you write for free, you're a sucker.
Like Samuel Johnson said that, right?
Okay, yeah, you're a sucker. You're being taken advantage of, right? Never write. You know, a doctor wouldn't do surgery for free. A pilot wouldn't fly a plane for free. Writers shouldn't write for free. But, and I know you're not writing for free per se, but like there is an element to this of like how, like it feels like a lot of your peers need the deal before they'll write.
It depends where you put EV, right?
Okay.
Expected
value, right?
Right. Where do you put the EV?
Right.
By the way, I the way I view the need for personal expression, I actually completely disagree with that quote. I understand what the quote is. It's talking about don't be taken advantage of. And it's also kind of making fun of the artistic impulse. It's saying, are you a professional or not?
Yeah.
But I would assert you can be a professional. You can act like a professional before you're paid as a professional. It depends how you're going to approach it. It depends what your expectations are. But our expected value, even though it might have been foolhardy to think so, was that there would be something on the other side of it. And I'll say this, the expected value of not doing the work is zero.
Okay.
Like there's no question about the EV of just thinking I'd like to write and not writing.
Right.
Well, if you had shown up and if you guys had just gone and tried to pitch, try to get an agent at that stage of your careers, would you have been able to do the project?
No, probably not, other than someone would have paid us $5,000. But
okay.
But then later, we did make the mistake of pitching at various times. And I mean, occasionally a pitch has become a movie for us. But for whatever reason, we've found that our strongest work is done in private, and then we take it out and show the world. And that's for us, we find that when you pitch an idea, as you know, when someone comes to pitch you, you're entering in a dialogue about this endeavor. And inevitably, what we found is a smart person would say something in the room, because let's assume for a moment that the people across the desk aren't idiots. Someone says something smart. You can't help but have them in your head when you're then going to do the work. And that might be a smart thing, but it really might not be the right thing. Because maybe I've only explained this this feeling that I have about what this thing could be. Maybe I've explained it in a way the best I could at that moment. But left to my own, it would take all sorts of different turns. But I have that phrase that the person uttered to me. And I have to keep returning to that for some reason because I've already let them inside this process.
I have a question about this though, because, you know, when we go back to this idea of
you had the confidence to do this in private and then put it out into the world. And even with Rounders, there was sort of a long staying power that came about with that. It wasn't like an instant like box office hit in one weekend.
That's right.
What's the time frame that you sort of A, gauge the success, and B, how do you sort of balance this sort of impetus from executives and other people in your life who care, who are producing and paying for these products, with sort of keeping the creative process intact without over-rotating on data?
So let me back up to answer that question. I have to tell you where I was before we wrote the first thing. And where I was in a pretty decent state of misery, because although I had a job that was well-paying and on the surface seemed creative, and although I had, I was lucky enough, even having Amy and then our first child was not a salve for the way I was feeling, which was like I wasn't doing this thing that I knew I had to pursue.
Yeah.
I wasn't doing the work. I was blocked. And I have this notion that when you're a blocked person, when you allow this creative impulse to be kept down, it dies. And like any other kind of death, there's toxicity that's attached to that. And as in the toxicity I knew would leach out and would actually make, you know, leach onto the people that I loved, because I would become a bitter person. And I wanted to be the kind of person who would come home and tell my kids that they should chase their dreams with rigor. You know, people often just think of it as a relic of the 60s, and it's like, hey, pursue your dreams, do your thing. But it's like, well, wait.
It's not a slogan.
If you have a dream, if you have a dream, work with incredible rigor and discipline to pursue it. And so I finally got to the place where I knew, and it wasn't about, can I have a movie in the movie theaters? What it was about was, can I find a way to have the courage to do the work that I'm worried I'll fail at, the work that I think is going to be meaningful? And so I decided to follow my curiosity and my obsessions. And it's not merely following your passion. What it is figuring out, if I'm obsessed, I'm incredibly curious, if I can get to the root of that and I can somehow create something out of it that is worthy, first of all, in the doing, I will change and become better. So to answer your question about success, the moment that I was in there for 2 hours a day, I was charged the rest of the day. So the job that had seemed mundane and bitter and sort of annoying to me was much easier to get through because I'd spent 2 hours already firing on all cylinders. And so that in the beginning, and of course, along a career, you can hold on to those things and you can let them go because we're all human, which means that we're all prey to, we can all fall prey to being judged by a standard that isn't our own. And we have to find a way to remind ourselves that our own standard is the standard that matters. So of course, I'm not going to say that the whole time I've been doing this, I only cared about what I felt like when I was doing the work. I will say that each time I have reframed and refocused to remember that what matters is what I feel like when I'm doing the work, it immediately makes me feel better. And then I immediately don't care about the rest of that stuff. Easier to say, of course, you might think easier to say because we've had this success, but I know I can point to a movie like Solitary Man, which was a commercial failure. I mean, it made its money back, but it was not a big commercial success. But I know it's the best movie we ever made. It got these incredible reviews, so I wasn't crazy. That's how I know, you know, this question I'm really interested in is delusion versus genius, or delusion versus capability. But I wouldn't change anything of the 4-year struggle to write that movie, and then we directed the movie, because as an artist, if you get to express the thing you want to express and then you get to make it, you've kind of won. The odds against are so great. Even the odds against completing something, right? Even the odds against actually showing up. I want to be a writer is way different than I am a writer. I want to be an artist is way different than I am an artist. And we decide when you get to give yourself those designations. But I was so sad, so miserable that... And it immediately changed upon doing the work. And so I have had to force myself to have that be the standard.
To go back to the state. So do you ever suffer from writer's block?
No, because I have rituals.
Like morning pages.
Could you describe that?
Yeah, I do. I do. I meditate every morning and I do morning pages every morning. So
morning pages?
Out of Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way, I do 3 longhand pages, a real brain dump where I just let the pen move for 3 pages no matter what. And it has this incredible effect on me. It's self-hypnosis. It's a brain dump so that you're putting all the dross just gets out there on the page. Also, it has the effect of, I can't be blocked. I've already written 3 pages. So you're in a state of flow. You're in a state of movement. That is the tool I used to become unblocked when I was 30. And when I was that unhappy and I said I had to try to write something, I had given Dave Awaken the Giant Within and Dave gave me The Artist's Way. And the combination of those things made me realize I had to figure out what it was that I really wanted to do and be. And then The Artist's Way gave me this tool to try to actualize it. And as soon as I started doing those pages, I was like, oh, I can do this. I can write. I can actually make good on it. And I've done it for 23 years.
Do you keep the pages?
No, you burn. My kids have instructions to burn upon my desk.
Upon your desk.
So I was going to say, I think, you know, decades or centuries later, these get published as the notebooks.
They can't. Right. I've read Camus' notebooks and Somerset Maugham's notebooks, and I'm happy that they exist, but that probably wasn't their intention.
So what did you get, when you guys sold Rounders or got the gun, whatever you want to say, the trigger got pulled.
Yes.
So what did you guys have when you walked in the room to do that at that point?
Well, so we finished the screenplay. It was first rejected. I mean, this is my favorite story. And I tell in detail on my blog, which is not a very active blog, at briankoppelman.com. But we were rejected by every single agency in Hollywood. One said it was overwritten. Another said it was underwritten. I still don't know what either of those terms mean. And I wrote down everything they all said. And this is an incredible Hollywood lesson because in the beginning, every rejection feels so personal. Mm-hmm. Every rejection also feels so final, right? In the beginning. So I wrote down what everyone said. And then we sold the thing. And that Monday, so we sold the thing over a weekend on a Monday. And by Tuesday, every single agency that had passed called us to try to sign us. And I read them all their comments. I had it on a yellow legal pad.
Right,
I just read them. I said, well, but you said that the thing was overwritten. I did. I read it to them all.
And it wasn't that the movie had gotten made and they liked it. It wasn't that the movie was a commercial success. It was simply that you
said nothing had intrinsically changed in the work itself.
Right.
And they all, nobody owned it. Not one of them said, you know what? I guess they all said, I didn't read it. It was my reader. It was my assistant. I meant to read it. I read the wrong script that was about poker and I thought it was your script. It was incredible. But it immediately framed the question for me for the rest of my career about who knows what. So then it's bought by Miramax and which is something I guess I used to say with pride. And Dave and I were just the writers. We weren't the producers on the movie. We weren't the directors of the movie, but and this has to do with continuing to work with rigor. There was a moment where they were going to hire a director who we thought would fire us off the movie and we thought would do a bad job. We met him. We didn't like him. And so even though it wasn't in our billet, we decided we'd better find a director who they would hire but who would be someone we felt we could work with. And it was really overstepping our position. And I think part of it is, and this gets into this, I know, part of it was that each of us were raised in environments where we saw people take these kinds of risks. And my dad was an entrepreneur, and I saw a lot of the time the way that he would just overstep his position to achieve a result. And so we found out through some sources who directors were that the movie company, who they were interested in making movies with. We triangulated that with people we could get to, and we found out that our agency represented John Dahl, who was really high on our list. And we said to our agents at the time, listen, we're going to stay in California until you can get us a meeting with John Dahl. And they were like, well, how are we going to do that? We said, well, send him this script, the letter that we write, and we'll just wait around. And they had all just competed to sign us, right? So this was the very beginning of this relationship with the agent. And in a way, he had to prove himself to us. So we were able to leverage the newness of the situation, even though often people in that situation think that they work for the agents. You know, the agents do a really good job of making people feel lucky to have them. But we were aware of the actual leverage in the situation. He got the script to John. John read it. Luckily for us, he really liked it. He came over and met us at our hotel. We all shook hands on it. We knew he was an honorable person. We then got to have this incredible moment, which now when I think back on it, I kind of can't even believe happened, which is we then called the producers and the studio and we said, John Dahl's going to direct Rounders. And they all went, well, that makes no sense. He's supposed to direct this other movie. How could you do that? You overstepped. And we all said, well, do you want John Dahl to direct the movie? And they all went, yeah. You know. And what was really great about that is then that allowed us to be on set every day because when you're the one who brought the director in and you have this relationship, plus John has no ego and he knew we understood the world of poker. Also, this incredibly lucky thing was we were the same age as Matt and Edward. And so there was a relationship that developed right away, which was we were going to take these guys and show them the world of underground poker. We were going to be experts about this. John Dahl gave us our limits. He was like, you have to really think carefully about what you say to actors. You can't contradict me. We're going to work together, but there's a chain of command. And then with that, he gave us complete freedom. Within that, he was like, now help me make the movie. But none of it would have happened if we would have pitched a movie, we would have been powerless.
Yeah.
We had ownership because we'd written the whole thing and we'd proven we were experts.
Can I ask you a quick question on this notion of ownership?
Yeah.
David Levine and you guys are both the showrunners for Billions. I'm dying to know how, because when a studio buys your show, someone is producing billions. It is your show as showrunner. Like, what if there's a conflict and you guys have like a huge falling out? And I'm thinking of the case of like the Sherman Paladinos and Gilmore Girls, and they had to exit before the last season, and it totally changed the last season of the show. And then they came back to remake the thing. Is there this thing where you're owning this thing that other people are now sharing in, and then you have to kind of give up your baby? Like, how does the ownership thing work?
I'll tell you, it's so analogous to the way a founder and will work with the investors, right? The VC, the board. It's up to you to manage that relationship. It's up to you to set the terms. And look, this does get into questions of privilege. Like, as two white men growing up with David's grandfather and my father were pretty successful, we learned at a young age how to talk to powerful people. Most people don't get an education in talking to powerful
people.
You're
so right about that.
And that, when people ask about advantages, yes, getting college paid for was a huge advantage, meaning that I knew I could take certain risks that other people couldn't because I didn't have a massive debt. But much more important, or certainly equally important, was from a young age, my dad would like put me in situations where I would have to deal with powerful people and I would have to find a way to get the result I wanted. He would let me be in a recording studio when he was making records and sometimes ask my opinion in a room full of incredibly scary, powerful people. He would let me be in meetings and he would leave
and
then I would conduct stuff.
For that.
And so I understood from a young age how to interact.
How do you talk to power, actually? Well, give us the advice for our listeners.
I can tell. Well, the main thing is don't treat them as most of the time. Don't treat them with a sense of awe and that they're like their station makes them better than you, but also don't try to condescend to them as though you're the smartest person in the world.
Right.
And you know, the biggest thing, make them laugh once in a while.
That's actually great.
I mean, right? Walk into a room, make them laugh, make them feel like you have the answers to their problems and that you're comfortable in your own skin. I mean, so much of what I'm talking about is an ingrained sense of comfort in your own skin, is being able to just continue to grow. You must always continue to grow, continue to better yourself, but find a way to sit there in the room relaxed and understand that you're not sitting there with the all-knowing, all-powerful Oracle or Oz. So, which is to say, to answer your question, it's our job to make the show, to make the actors comfortable, to make the crew feel empowered, to make sure the show is written, edited, and shot right. It's also our job to make the show on budget, to communicate with Showtime, if there's going to be, hey, guess what? This next week, it's going to look like we're over, but here's how we're going to solve that the week after. Also to make them feel heard when they're talking about the show.
You're so right.
If they're giving notes, make them feel heard, make them know that you actually are listening. Then it's really important that we only take the notes that'll make the show better and that we do that in a way that makes them feel good about the
process. That's fantastic advice. That's so great. I feel like that can apply to any business.
It does. I think that applies across the board.
You know how I coach people how to do that?
How do you? Yeah.
From Larry Sanders. From Artie. From Artie.
So tell us. I don't know.
We both love Larry Sanders, like my third favorite show of all time.
Yeah. If people haven't seen it,
I don't even know what that is.
You must watch it immediately. So Artie, the producer, played by the legendary the legendary Rip Torn played Artie the producer. And so typically we see this with young people a lot in here, which is like you give somebody, in your world it's called a note, in our world it's like feedback or it's like, you know, here's an idea. And you give somebody an idea and like they immediately get their back up, right? Well, they do one of two things. They either like take it way too seriously and they like try to do everything you tell them, or they get their back up and they get offended, like how dare you question my vision kind of stuff. And then that sets up a weird dynamic where you feel like you can't talk to them, right? And so both of those are bad, right? One way you basically hijack their creative vision, usually to bad effect. The other way is you end up with a hostile relationship. And so Artie's whole approach of dealing with the network executives in Larry Sanders is a show inside a show, basically. It's a show about a show. His way of dealing with the suits from the network was basically that, you know, they'd say, well, I don't know, you know, I think that, you know, the curtain at the talk show is red. We really think it should be purple. And Artie would literally say, that is a really interesting idea. I am really going to think hard about that one. And he read it on his legal pad and looked, okay, you know, what else do you have? Right. And then, of course, you know, in the show, the suit leaves the room. He rips up the paper.
Yeah, rips up the paper.
And the suits are on their way out. And they're like, that was the best meeting ever.
Yeah.
Because sure, it's a feeling that you've been heard.
And so that's like, what I'm telling people is like, that's the baseline. Like, if you can just do that, you're better than most. And then to your point, if on top of that, you can actually consider and actually absorb some of the
and
feedback.
And sometimes, listen, that nobody's, might be good. Nobody's perfect. Right. So there are times I'm working 17 hours a day and somebody gives me a note I really disagree with. And I might say, I might once in a while say, listen,
I tend to say kind of like, fuck off. That's a stupid idea.
I sometimes say that's a stupid idea. But here's the thing. If you have the right kind of relationship with the people with whom you work, you can say that. Because they know that's not your default position, and they understand because you're in dialogue with them, but not operating from a place. No one's operating from a place of fear, hurt, or misunderstanding. And by the way, if you say that's the stupidest fucking note I ever heard, call them the next day and say, "Let me tell you what was going on yesterday. Here's the way I'm going to think about addressing it, or read this and tell me if you still think so." It's a constant. You constantly have to remember if you're in our position. That you're grateful to be in this situation, but that you're not an indentured. You're not so grateful that you're going to prostrate yourself and ruin the thing in the process.
Of course.
And if you remember that, you're in okay shape.
The part that I always struggle with here, and I wonder if a lot of people struggle with this, is that I have always had this belief that competency is the thing that will always get you ahead. The result will speak for itself. How do you sort of play back the results to tell the story that you want? Because oftentimes, like the Rounders example, like this is the conversation that's happening around the movie, because people have ways of defining those things. I think that's a really big challenge. How do you sort of define it so that you can make sure that the narrative you want told your way, is that part of the point? I mean, in terms of how people perceive
when
your
you're
work?
A showrunner of a going concern, you're going to get to prove it out or not prove it out because you're making the show. And I will say, certainly in the relationship we have with Showtime, all their notes are suggestions. And so Dave and I are getting to prove it out every episode. I will say we did. So, okay, there are a few other things. It's not a bad thing to learn the mistakes people have made ahead of you. It's not bad to do research and know, well, what is the third rail in this situation, right? So if the third rail in the situation is don't go more than 3% over budget on a given episode without having conversations, that is the third rail, then don't be a jerk. You're in an incredibly lucky situation to find a way to do what you have to do. But there are many other non-budgetary examples. So here's how a pilot works. When I lay this example out, there will be parallels to your world. So a pilot gets greenlit. They give you this amount of money to go make the pilot. And you're in, they've already approved the script. You cast the show together. So that's another one of these things where you're trying to find a way to express your opinions, make sure you have the cast you want while understanding we're in the real world. You're not going to cast a complete unknown to play the lead unless you have a bunch of other ways to say, well, that's okay because in these three spots we have people who aren't. But then once that stuff's done, guys, go off, make your show, right? Because once it starts going and before it's edited, there is no feedback they can really give you. You're making the show. You're making the show. You go in the editing room after you have all this material. You know the show is going to fit in an hour-long slot. But most people, when they cut their pilot, because they don't actually have the real limitation of an hour, will turn in a 67-minute pilot because every idea they had, everything they want to be there. Now, David and I, because by the time Billions had come around, we'd been doing this for a long time. And what happens when you give the 67-minute thing is you're inviting a bunch of people to tell you how to get the thing to 57 or 58 minutes.
Yep. The crowdsourcing and problem.
Suddenly they're giving you their opinion on it. Also, by you not having to have rigorously, with discipline, make those decisions, you've inevitably left in a bunch of stuff that is you shouldn't have. So Dave and I decided, and no matter what, we're turning something in that's 57 or 58 minutes. Maybe 56 if we could do it. We're going to take all of those questions off the table before showing it to the people who put up the money. And I'll tell you, we gave them this cut and we're realistic people. So we knew all the flaws and the things we would want to reshoot before it would go on the air. But they're going to make it, maybe some of the audience doesn't know. When you shoot a pilot, there's no guarantee you're going to have a series, right? They've invested a bunch of money. Showtime's known for if they make a drama pilot, it's very likely they're going to put it on the air, but you don't know. And so we turn over this pilot, and the first thing they said to us when they called us was, you guys have already done all the stuff that normally takes a month for us to work through with showrunners, which is you've gotten the thing into show shape.
Yeah.
And so that's because we looked ahead at best practice, true best practices. Wanted, yeah. And by the way, it's hard, right? It's actually when you're in the, then you're in the situation, you understand why everybody turns in at 67 minutes because you don't have to, it's much easier to not have to make those decisions.
Totally.
Right? It's much easier to hand those decisions.
It takes a lot of confidence actually, quite frankly.
Yeah, it's easier to offload those decisions to the ex, to someone else, the people who are paying for it. Instead, we said, you know, we're going to make these choices and we're going to show them that this is the vision we have for the show. And it, our structure, I think I put the pilot script online at my, I think I put it online at the blog. And if you go look at it, I put Rounders up there too, which people have really been reading a lot lately. But if you look at it, structurally, it's quite different than the pilot that got on the air. Different scene starts it. And because when we got in the editing room, we decided, well, now we have the opportunity to make the show be the best version of itself. We were able to gain objectivity, even though it was all of our hearts in there.
It's only in the edit that you get that arc, totally.
And then so one message you're delivering is like, here's an incredible product. The meta message I think you're delivering is you guys are professionals.
Yes. And they said that to us. They explicitly said, we know your showrunners who can make the show.
You're the pros.
That was what gave, so this goes to your question of the relationship. How do you establish a relationship with them?
Show you're a pro.
That makes them your a professional we can trust. And by the way, as you know, all you want is a founder, CEO, who can not make it your job to run the company and just take the best of your ideas. Yeah. And you want them to discard the worst of your ideas.
Go knock it out of the park.
Right.
Go do your thing.
By the way, that's hard. Those are hard won lessons over a career.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right, those aren't, right. those, we were 20 years in
no,
by the
right.
time.
You learned that.
I think we sold Rounders in 1997 and we made the pilot of this in 2015. So that's a long period of time over which we figured this stuff out.
So for people who aren't aware, there's a very interesting kind of split in how movies are made and how TV shows are made, at least these days, which is movies are made, generally the writer writes the script, turns it over, and then other people run with it. And other people being presumably the producers, and then particularly the director.
The director, right?
Director ends up actually running the project in a lot of ways, right? Maybe with a line producer or something. For TV shows, especially, it seems like in the last couple decades, you have this concept of showrunner, and it's the writers are often, or usually at this point, the showrunners. And I'm picturing, I don't know, Louis B. Mayer or, you know, Jack Warner or somebody, you know, being told that the writers should run the project and probably screaming and being very upset, like that would be impossible. And so two-part question, what was the left turn in the industry that caused the writers to get in a position where they could be the showrunners? And then what did you guys do as writers to make sure that you specifically were able to do that?
So there's this great book called Difficult Men by Brett Martin that's about five showrunners. David Simon, David Chase, Vince Gilligan, Sean Ryan, and one other that I'm not remembering right now.
And this is Breaking Bad, The Shield.
That's right.
The Sopranos, and The Wire.
Right. But he goes into the history of it. And Hill Street Blues is when this first, because they were making this kind of serialized show. And Stephen Bochco started having meetings with the directors. When the director would come in, he would start having meetings saying, let me set the tone. He was executive. Nobody named him showrunner, but he decided that he was going to, had to, because of the nature of that show, exert upon the situation a kind of tone, a control of the voice and tone.
Because most shows up to the successful shows have been more like Law and Order was like the apotheosis of the other way around, which is each episode is independent.
Yes.
Right.
Hill Street Blues was one of the first shows that sort of combine these elements for a cop show, I think, right. For sure. Right. But the answer to your question is about Dave and me and about anyone who wants to be a showrunner, which I'm happy that showrunner is officially in the dictionary now. Like 2 years ago, it became in the dictionary.
I'm so glad. I know. I love that word.
Because it's a real job title now. Like, what do you do for a living? Showrunner. It's learning to be a producer. We have 150 people who work with us, but we're in charge of. And so, and it is quite different. But you know, as you know, David and I directed movies and we produced movies. So for us, it was quite a natural thing because we'd already, you know, at Rounders was as good an experience as you could have as a writer. And there were still areas in which we didn't have enough control over the voice. And what we also knew was we're probably never going to get that exact situation again. So we'd better learn how to do these other parts of it. We better learn how to gain control of the, you know, mechanisms of production.
The means of production.
The means of production. That's exactly right. And so we realized that we ought to do that. But again, that goes back to this question of often a writer is takes solace while they're whining about not having control. They take solace in not having control because
right.
If you don't have control, you don't take the blame.
Somebody else's fault.
So if you're comfortable, if you can find a way to be comfortable with failure, which as a writer you have to, or comfortable in your mistakes, then you can be comfortable in wanting to be the final voice on what the product is going to be. And we very early on decided, and I'll say this, when we work with Steven Soderbergh, we are so glad to have his voice. If he's directing the movie, man, what a thrill to work with a genius, right? And what a thrill to have Soderbergh make us better. To this day,
like, this was Steven, Ocean's 13.
Yeah, but also The Girlfriend Experience, and then he produced Solitary Man. I mean, if Steven called tomorrow and said that he wanted us to just be screenwriters on a movie he was directing, we would jump at it because he's going to make our stuff better. But if you're comfortable in, if you're comfortable taking the blame, if you're comfortable in a position of control, it makes you incredibly comfortable to then cede that control or to share with somebody else. And so you can pick your spots then and decide. And also because we're able to make our own stuff, it's, the being in a situation where we are not the final voice doesn't make us chafe against it. But I have plenty of that over here. So I don't have to chafe against it over here.
Totally.
I'm happy to play this role in this situation.
Fantastic. I love this.
That's why we're good producing other people's movies. When it's someone else's vision, we're great at just helping them achieve their vision. Like Neil Berger, who's an incredibly successful director, director of the pilot of Billions. We produced his first three movies. And it's like, hey, Neil, we're here to advise, counsel, help. It's your movie. Go run with it. We're comfortable in any of those different modes creatively, but I think the reason for that is that we got comfortable early on with just doing the work and failing.
That's right. We've been talking a lot about kind of managing up hierarchically, so to speak. Now, turning it the other direction, like managing down in the writer's room, you've got like a lot of writers working with you. So how do you now navigate debates with all those writers in the writer's room? Like you, essentially, you're the showrunners. And how do you make it collaborative yet not a democracy at the same time?
Like, well, it isn't a democracy.
Right.
So different showrunners approach the question of the writer's room differently. And some who've come up through a writer's room rely on it in a very deep way.
Describe a writer's room.
A writer's room is you get, let's say, six people in the room plus a showrunner. There's a whiteboard and you start at the beginning of the season and it's like, where are we and how do we fill that in? And then but then it's really hard to describe a writer's room, Mark, because writer's rooms become extensions of the way the showrunners see the world and the way they see the world of their shows. So
in theory, it's a team of people writing the show together in some form.
Meaning maybe everybody will write an episode. Almost all shows, the showrunner does the final pass on all the episodes, no matter whose name is going on.
Yeah, like the top edit.
On our show, though, David and I end up writing most of the show. And we have a great room of men and women who help us really break the story arc of the season. And that is an invaluable process. Tons of stuff comes out of the room about how the big arc of the season should occur, about the twists and turns, about where characters, and that's a months-long process of talking. We haven't yet found, and then when it comes to writing the scripts, David and I, and then we have a writer named Adam Perlman, who's now a co-executive producer. He's our number two person. And Adam writes a good amount of the show too. But the truth is it is mostly us writing it. And I'm not saying that's the way it should be on every show. The voice of our show, the way that our show is canted, whether you like our show or not, our show is canted in a certain way. It has a very clear voice that somehow the two of us can do. Now, that said, if someone on the team starts a script, their name goes on it, ours does not.
So you got a young hotshot writer and they have an opportunity to write on a show that's maybe not as, let's say, critically respected or whatever, but maybe it's like they know that they'll actually get to write scripts. And
yes.
What's your pitch to them of why they should come work for you, given that it's a more constrained environment?
I'm not sure. Well, Adam was somebody who had a lot of job offers when he came on our show in the second season. He started on the second season, came into the room as just a producer level, which is kind of a low level position in terms of the hierarchy. He wasn't helping to be a showrunner, but he came in the room. He had incredibly good ideas. He then wrote his first script that he wrote was very strong, and strong enough that when someone's script came in that was not that strong, and David and I had to work on three other things, we called him in and we said, hey, take a shot at rewriting this. Here are the things that matter. We made extensive notes. Adam, go try to rewrite it. He rewrote that script. We then sat with him and talked about how we were going to now rewrite it, but he did a really good job. We kept being able to go to him. And by the next season, season three, he was running the room when we weren't there. We bumped him three positions. We bumped him up to co-executive producer really quickly and said, like, look, you're our creative partner now. Like, help us do this. So if you're really great, if you're great in the way that our show requires,
right?
Someone may kill it on another show and just not kill it on ours. I mean, the other thing is they get to be on set, watch how a show is made, and be a part of it. I'll say one thing, though, to answer your question, which is some people have come into the writer's room, talented, and I found out they came into the writer's room because they like my podcast. But I've had to say to them, I'm this incredibly nurturing and encouraging voice on the podcast. And I want you to know, like, I am that for you in your life, and I'll, like, help you get your next job, and I'll be, but you're going to turn in a script, and you're not going to get the voice on the podcast.
Oh my God,
You're going to get somebody saying to you, here's what doesn't work. And so you have to know that we're in the major leagues here. We have no choice because we're playing the Red Sox tomorrow. So we have to be ready to get in there and play the Red Sox. So that has happened twice.
So one more question about Rounders, which goes to the kind of current state of the industry. So Rounders was made in when? It was
97.
97. So that was the heyday of kind of the high status independent movie.
Yeah.
Like medium budget, but like super high status.
And 14.5 we made that for, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And then as you said, like it had the thing, it wasn't a huge commercial hit out of it, but then it had this long life, you know, kind of you know, plays out through now and probably long into the future. If that movie had not gotten made, and if a movie like that had not gotten made, nobody had made kind of the definitive poker movie, and you and David entered the industry today at age 25 or 30 or whatever it is and decided to make that movie or that project today, what would be different about the process?
People constantly ask me how to break in to the business. And my answer is, I have no idea. I did it 23 years ago.
Okay.
I can't help you. I wish I could help tell you how to break in. The conditions on the ground are entirely different. The last thing I want to be is some general back in thing, ignoring what the sergeant says. Like, I have no idea. I do know that what I know is that, well, I think it would resemble a movie that I love and that launched many careers, which is Margin Call. Right. But whereas Rounders was a 14.5, I think Margin Call was made for $1.2 million and scraped together by a commercial director, and they had limited sets. And that now, because Margin Call has a lot of similarities to Rounders, it's set in an insular world with a language of its own. It doesn't spell anything out for you. Like, you have to be willing to roll with it.
We should describe, it's kind of the definitive movie of the September 2008 financial meltdown. It kind of takes place overnight, effectively in Lehman Brothers.
Yes.
And it's like a fictionalized version of Lehman Brothers. And it's actually a very chilling, people in finance look at it.
Goldman. Like, well, it's Goldman, right? Because they survive.
Okay.
I think it's set at Goldman, and it's about the willingness of Goldman. And they never say it's Goldman. It's about the willingness of, it's about a decision that Goldman Sachs made to get rid of their toxic assets. But I think that movie is really analogous to Rounders because it is doing a bunch of the stuff that we did. You have to just like catch on to the lingo, and you have to understand what the stakes are. And but he had to look. They made that movie for a tenth of what we made.
They had Kevin Spacey. They had Jeremy Irons. Zachary Quinto was in it when he was starting to become famous.
That's right.
Top end.
They put the top end people, but it was still, they had to make it for like $1.5 million bucks, right. $1.2 million maybe.
Okay,
it's much harder to make those those sort of mid budget 14 to 25 or $30 million movies, though Netflix does it, right? You can do it at Netflix now, which is probably where it would happen. But or you would try to tell the story in a novelistic way.
That was really my question. So would you pitch today, young David and young Brian show up? Would you pitch Rounders for television or for a film?
No, you would pitch the world of the underground card rooms for television.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of that's where this stuff lives. And that would have been, I think, a fascinating thing to see also. David and I grew up watching movies. We loved television, but our shared language, our lingua franca, was movies. We were quoting movies at each other from when we were little kids. We would watch movies 20 times. You know, we watched Stripes together at least 20 times, and Diner, and many more movies where they became the way we communicated. And so it made sense to us to go make movies. Since then, you know, things like The Sopranos, West Wing, Larry Sanders, Mad Men showed up and showed us the way. They lit the way, sort of, for us to think about television.
Right? Yep. That's actually huge. We always talk about this, Mark and I. Television is so much better than movies. It's unbelievable.
Well, I think it's the best shows. They are novels.
Well, I think we all think
or series of novels.
I call it visual literature.
A movie is still more like a play.
It's visual
these shows
literature.
These shows are like 1,000-page novels.
We definitely think totally. We definitely think of it that way.
Yes.
We're trying to tell novelistic stories, deepening characters in challenging situations.
I call it visual literature. It's exactly what it is.
I love that term.
So we you came up in the music industry. I watched music. I was involved in the internet. I wasn't involved in Napster, but I knew the guys really well. And so we both watched from various professional perches, kind of the music industry confront digital distribution and basically just like implode, right?
Oh, yeah, get run over. But they didn't confront it.
Right.
Unfortunately, they didn't confront it. They just stood there and got
right.
They were like, they just got run over.
Kablooey, right?
France in the deuce, man. They were like, should we pick up our guns and their rifles? No, let's just lay down.
That's a comment brought to you entirely by Brian.
No, Mark, you signed up. You laughed. You completely laughed.
I fully expected the same thing was going to happen to TV. Like, use Napster for music, use BitTorrent for TV. And it's just obvious. Same thing's going to happen to TV. It's just going to get run over. And then the most like amazing thing in the world happened, which is the exact opposite thing happened. The opposite happened, which is like the creative explosion of all time. Like and you've probably seen, John Landgraf, who runs FX, is always talking about
brilliant man.
Brilliant man, right? Great programmer, but he talks about the content bubble, the TV bubble. And it's like, I don't know, every year now it's like 500 original scripted dramas are getting made.
I think it's 560 or something insane.
Yeah. And so, and he's been calling this a bubble the whole time, but like it keeps expanding. And I mean, then we all get to, you get to make it, but like we get to watch it. And it's I routinely see shows now where I'm just like, 20 years ago, this would have been the best show in the entire
the
history
of
television.
The fact that Mindhunter and The Crown came out like in the same year on Netflix.
Oh my God. Yes.
Is amazing to me. Those would have been the best show of an era.
Ever. Ever.
Ever. Right. Like The Crown is as good as you can make something. And like,
I keep trying to make Mark watch it. He hasn't.
I can give you the language by which to watch it. So I'm totally not interested in monarchy. I hate it. Nothing about that is interesting to me. The show is just the most beautifully written and shot and acted show that there is.
He doesn't believe me.
So here's my question. Let's assume it's not a bubble. Let's assume it is the medium of our time. And let's assume it kind of keeps expanding so that this all makes sense. But the amazing thing is it seems like the more shows get made, it seems like the average quality level is rising. And you would expect, I think, the opposite. You'd expect the average quality level to fall because you'd expect to run out of talent at some point.
I agree.
And so where is all this talent coming from?
Yes. I have no idea.
Okay. So were there just all these geniuses out there who just never had the opportunity to do it and now they do? Or is there something happening in the industry where people are being trained in a different way?
Or maybe it's the love of television so it perpetuates itself. And we might be in a golden age where artists are apprenticing in some way for other artists and learning and figuring it out. I have the luxury not to think about the 560 shows or to appreciate what Landgraf says and know he's a brilliant guy without having to be cowed by that or feel any way about it because I still go back to the same thing. I just want to get in the room and get the feeling I get when I'm making the thing. I want to walk on the set and see Damien and Paul and Maggie and Asia and be able to work with them. We've just found a way to make decisions still based on our curiosity and our obsession. So if we're interested in the US Open in 1991 and Jimmy Connors, we'll go make a documentary about it because we'll really enjoy the process of making it and we have faith that there'll be people who will want
to
see it.
I was thinking my answer to Mark's question, I'm trying to make him watch this movie Gully Boy. And
I haven't seen it.
It's a Bollywood movie that's produced by Nas, but to me, the point is that technology has democratized the access to watching all this visual literature.
I don't understand. Ben is not able to make him watch something produced by Nas. That doesn't make any, sense to me.
Ben and I have the kind of partnership where we're able to, we're able to compliment. Yes. Actually, I wanted to ask you, that was the other question I wanted to ask you. So you have been partners now with David for how long?
Over 20 years.
It's an equal partnership.
One has always been from the beginning.
Okay, equal partnership.
Fully 50-50.
Beautiful.
So if somebody comes to you and says, like, I want to have a partnership like that. I want to have a career where I have a partner like that. Like,
do you remember when the four of us first met, how funny it seemed to us when me, you, Ben, and David.
The two pairs of partners.
We were sitting there and it was just like, this is a rare thing to have two sets of people who just, it in the same way it makes sense when someone sees you and Ben and talks to you for 5 minutes. When someone sees David and me and they talk to us for 5 minutes, the whole thing just kind of makes sense. Like in the ways that we can finish each other's sentences, but also are different in some significant ways that probably if someone else heard us talking, we're maybe very similar, but the two of us understand the ways in which we're complementary to each other. The key is to really regard the other person as incredibly smart, to really always know that their motive is to make the work better. So much of the stuff sounds like platitudes. But like trying your hardest to get your emotions out of these decisions and being rational. I think the key to having a good partnership is not about looking for the partner. It's about how can you make yourself be the best version of yourself in a way that complements this other person who you respect and whose work you admire. And so that's all hard work in life, right? It's the same thing in a marriage and any kind of a
partnership.
A partnership. But it's about all of us, even the most rational, smartest among us, have emotional reactions sometimes. And the question is, okay, it's not to not have an emotional reaction, but it's to not let the emotional reaction dictate your response. So if that means you know that you normally, you're the worst of you instantly reacts with anger, then find a way to take the, to say, hey, I don't want to react with anger. I'm going to go take a run and then I'm going to come back. And this is stuff you figure out over a long period of time. But the more you know that the success or failure of a partnership is based entirely on how you comport yourself, the better off that you'll be.
It's not the other guy's fault. Agree? That's right. It can't be the other guy's fault.
Don't you think of it that way?
I actually am curious what Mark's take on this is.
Yeah, what is your take on that?
No, so this comes up a lot in our business. Ben and I have this kind of partnership, lucky for me, but also that, there's a lot of like founder and then CEO. Like sometimes we have founder CEOs, which is like your showrunner model, but sometimes we have a founder and then there's a CEO who's brought in or promoted inside the company. And then they have to be part, if you want the magic of the founder and the company to be well run, they need to have that kind of partnership. And so what I always tell them, I kind of try to put a point on it and kind of say, it has to be more important to each of you that the other one gets to make the decision than that you get to prove yourself right. And you both have that attitude. Like if one of you has that attitude, then that person's just going to run over the other one. But if you both have the attitude where your reflexive view is, you know what, this is a debate, it's an argument, it's 50-50, it's a toss-up, which a lot of these things are, we're going to do it your way. If both people have that as their default point of view,
right,
then you can navigate through these things. And then you get in the positive version of the deadlock, which is let's do it your way. Okay, now we have
you're
a healthy
totally
conversation
right.
Going,
sometimes there'll be emails back and forth about a thing in an editing where one of us will have an idea and the other one will say, my instinct was to go the other way with it, but you know what, let's do it that way. And it's not even it has to not be a move, I think.
Right,
you have to actually be
you have to really be open
to
it.
There was a thing yesterday where I saw something and I had a notion about it. And David sent me back, there are a few different things that are good. So normally when we're doing edits making notes on a cut in order to do edits, our two assistants, we share two assistants. It's not like one's his assistant and one's mine. We have two assistants who help the two of us. Normally they're on the conversation so that they can then collate the notes and give them to the editor before we go talk to the editor. But if there's something that suddenly is we see really differently, we just immediately take it to a private communication, right? We take the audience out of it. We never talked about this, but we just do it. We take the audience out of it because
we're
not performing and we're also not worried about being judged. But so yesterday was one of those things where we just saw one little tiny moment slightly differently. I wrote this thing, like, I think we should do this. And then Dave wrote me separately and said, I don't see the scene that way. Here's what I think's going on. And I still saw the scene the way that I saw it, but I just immediately went, let's do it your way. It makes total sense. Like, let's go through the next bunch of iterations of the cut with it in like that, and in the hope that I'm just going to come around to seeing it that way.
Right.
Or let's show it to some other people this way, and let's see what comes out of it. It would have been very easy, and I see a lot of people fall into the trap of trying to argue.
Well, I look for as many chances as I can to let him make the decision, right? And then to your point, like if I really feel, and as a consequence of that, I build up so much trust.
That's right.
If I feel strong about something,
then you can say it.
That's a really great point. And this is important to attach to that, which is because all the time Dave is willing to say to me, let's do that. When he wrote me and said like, hey, dude, I think this is different than you think it is. It was just so easy to go, well, yeah, of course, dude. Go, let's do that thing because you're always looking
that.
To let it be the way I want it.
Right? Yeah.
I am. So I would say I'm certain none of that is a tactic or a strategy with Dave and me. It just so happens to be the way that the two of us interact.
A quick question on this, though, is just from like an advice point of view, because you talk about this. How do you manage your own personal psychology around anger and creative impulse and ego kind of in this process, even beyond the partnership?
Well, meditation helps.
Mm-hmm.
I know, as I said before, some of this stuff sounds so reductive and so much like platitudes. But, I love that Tim Ferriss has said out of the whatever 1,000 people he's interviewed who he views as highly successful creatives, like 92% of them meditate. And I don't think that's just buy-in. I don't think it's just that everyone's decided to buy in.
So I'm in the 8%.
Yeah, I know.
I'm like Mr. Anti-Meditation.
I'm not into
anti-meditation.
Well, I've never. I'm not philosophically anti-meditation. I'm personally anti-meditation. I cannot imagine sitting still with my own thoughts for longer than about 30 seconds.
I couldn't either originally.
And so this is my question. So talk to me as a practical person who's interested in performance and not particularly interested in introspection. Like how would
I do the simplest kind? I do transcendental meditation. Okay. So it's the easiest One, because it's just quietly saying a mantra to yourself for 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, define transcendental meditation.
Well, that's what it is. Transcendental meditation is you because I have ADHD person. I can't sit still. I have to check all that stuff. Except I really do this twice a day, 20 minutes. And what I found, and it's just personal, but what I found was it like reduced the physical manifestations of anxiety by a lot. And when you get, for me, when I get anxiety out of the equation, I just think more clearly and more creatively. So it's not, the other thing is people build it up too much, right? It's not some magic pill. It doesn't like immediately make you,
you're
not suddenly becalmed, but it just kind of takes like a little bit of the tumult out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of forms of meditation require you to force out the thoughts, as you said, or require you to be introspective, or require you to focus on your breathing. Transcendental meditation, all you're doing is sort of allowing this mantra to be said over and over. And if thoughts come in, that's fine. You just kind of let the thoughts come in, and then you kind of return to this mantra. And I'll say the results for me, so I was hugely skeptical, but I was at a point where I was feeling like I needed something. I had too much agitation. And so I read David Lynch's book, Catching the Big Fish, and a couple of other books, and it made me interested enough. And I went and sat down with Bob Roth, who runs the Lynch Foundation. And I said, look, I think you're probably a cult. I think that I'm an atheist. I know these are like Sanskrit words that have some holiness to them. So none of that stuff works for me. So talk to me about why I should even be sitting here. And you know, Bob was like, well, why don't you read this book and why don't you read this study and why don't you look at these EEGs and let's talk about what this tool does in terms of affecting the loops in your brain and your brain waves. And through that conversation, I was like, well, okay, I'll learn. And within 2 months, I noticed and my family noticed that I was just in a much better place. And again, it doesn't mean I'm never a dick. Like we're all a dick sometimes. It doesn't mean I'm never short with anyone or that I'm never worried. Of course I am. I'm a human being. But it means that I can manage it in a much better way. And if the only thing I got out of it was I was sitting and meditating and when you're not trying to think of ideas, but like I've solved many tricky story problems. I've come out of a meditation and just kind of had the answer show up. Now that could just be a function of like, I turned everything off and I consciously wasn't thinking about it. And so
your body, mind went to work.
That's great, perfect. Whatever it is, it's not surprising to me that so many of us who are high achievers, aggressive in going after what we want, willing to take risks, that finding some tool that gives you some enforced break from that, it's not surprising to me that then when you then come out of that, you're kind of firing again.
So that's just what makes sense to me about it.
So
who's Bob? Sorry, who's Bob?
Bob Roth runs David Lynch Foundation. David Lynch Foundation is like at the center of transcendental meditation. Lynch had this idea, the director David Lynch. David Lynch is the biggest, is the reason transcendental meditation is popular in America. Lynch credits TM with making him the artist that he is.
David Lynch, Twin Peaks, Blue Velvet.
Oh, yeah, all that stuff. Yeah. He started doing it like 40 years ago or 50 years ago. And he wanted to start a thing that would give it to kids and post-traumatic stress people. So he started this foundation and the guy who runs it and who's like sort of the head of TM in America is this guy, Bob Roth.
The best part of that story, by the way, though, is that you're literally arguing to Mark's point about this tent, because Mark essentially set it up as a tension between performance and introspection. And you're essentially arguing that introspection leads to better performance. Which
I would argue that it's not introspection. Okay. Like my journaling is definitely a certain kind of introspection serves me, but meditation is like the calming of the thoughts or the stilling of it, or it's just a respite in a way. It's a respite from the perpetual thinking machine thing.
Right.
I think the idea is that you have these thoughts, these pattern of thoughts, and there are some thoughts that you know you have, but then there are these like patterns of thoughts that you have that are probably a little bit disruptive, but they're a loop. And when you start to say this mantra, you're interrupting, right? Suddenly that's what the sound is and the other thing just dissipates and you get calm. I'm not trying to think about my life when I'm meditating. I'm just trying to take a break.
Yeah. Okay,
Let's spend the last few minutes just talking about Billions specifically. Podcast friends, we're about to go into some light spoiler alerts, particularly from the last and early seasons. So if you haven't seen them already, you've been warned. I have to ask this question because you know that scene from As Good As It Gets where there's a female character that goes to Jack Nicholson and he's just like,
I sacrifice, take away honor and what's the exact
line?
Well,
actually, I was thinking of another thing.
I have not seen this movie. So
you haven't? Well, okay.
You guys have to describe.
I thought you were going to say the one where I think of a man and then I take away reason. And
yes, well, that was his response to her because the question that I have is how do you write women so fucking well?
Well, that's his answer,
and
yes.
Right. And
I wildly disagree with his answer.
Which is good to hear. But the best characters on Billions are quite honestly the female and transgender characters of Maggie Siff, who plays Wendy Rhodes, and Asia Kate Dillon, who plays Taylor. I mean, I want to ask you, how do you do this incredible character development for these female characters?
You know, the hardest questions to answer are the how do you do the thing?
Because that's
the part that's not, there is no intellectual answer to that question. That's the part of it that either makes you someone who does this or doesn't do it. The most fun part for me is when I'm sitting on my couch actually writing the scenes, right? I have music blasting, able to put the computer, the laptop actually on my lap, and I'm able to sort of fly. And that's the part that isn't intellectual at all. It's the result of all the intellectual work you've ever done. It's the result of your curiosity. It's the result of everything you've read, of everything that you've watched, of everything that you've been a part of. And then you want to just allow it to happen. And so we honor these characters. Wendy Rhodes, when we invented that character and wrote her, we certainly know who that person is very well. But you have to make these fictional characters feel incredibly real to you, and you want to write them smarter than you are. And that's the only thing I can say is we want every character in Billions to be smarter than we are.
So a quick question about Taylor as a character, because Billions, the next season is now dropping. You ended the last season with a tension between the head of Axe Capital and his protege, Taylor, starting their own firm. And I so relate to Taylor's character, like you won't believe. There's a sense of like unbounded ambition.
Are you trying to tell Mark something
no,
right now?
No, because not in that sense.
This happened before.
There's this unbounded ambition with Taylor. And Axe initially nurtures it and then essentially squashes it. I'm dying to know, like, Taylor's a really interesting archetype, actually, both that Taylor's transgender and that you have this essential universal archetype in every organization. Tell me how you think about Taylor as a character.
Well, yeah, Taylor's just the most highly competent person and is a brilliant person. And like, if this is a long novelistic piece, we're still sort of at the middle, the beginning of the middle of the story. And so that kind of person has to be tempted, right? Has to be tested. If you don't test, right, if you don't test the morality of those kind of characters, how do you know whether they're really moral or not? If they don't get lost for a little while, how do they become found? And so that's where we find Taylor in this season. I don't want to spoil anything.
Okay, but I have another quick one. I'm just dying to ask, and we'll lightning round these and then we'll wrap up. I want to ask you about some of the music choices you make and one specific one. Last season, one of the most compelling raw music choices you made is in a scene, for those who haven't caught up all the way, I'll just give a little teaser, where Axe essentially is let out of a situation where he was in trouble and he's coming back to his pad. And it's literally, you guys portray it visually as a completely raw bachelor pad. And the song was Street Punk.
Vince Staples, yeah.
Oh my God, I fucking love that moment. It so stripped him bare down to just, he's a street punk. Tell me about that decision and that choice.
I mean, David and I choose all the music for the show together, and we're both music fanatics and trade music all the time. And so, and we put music in the scripts. So when we're writing that script, we're going back and forth about what it should be. Is it hip hop? If it is, who is it and why? We had Vince Staples on the list since the end of the first season, I think, when his first record came out. North North is what I thought we would use from the beginning. But that moment, you know, that moment, people really understand what happens when Axe gets in that hot tub. And again, that was in the script. That was what our goal was. And then we had to work incredibly hard with our brilliant editor who figured out how to make that sequence work the way we'd had it in our heads. Marnie Mayer, who edited that episode, really worked incredibly hard to build that sequence so that it matched and then exceeded what we had written. And Marnie's been with the show from the very beginning. She and an editor named Naomi Garrity have been with the show from the start and are really and truly our creative partners. They're the guardians of the tone of the show with us.
That's great. All right, I'll ask one last one and then we can wrap up. So in season one, does this count as a spoiler alert? Because it's so early in the season. I'll just give it a high level.
We'll decide.
Okay. There's a scene where you essentially set up Axe. The entire audience thinks that he's going to cheat on his wife.
Yeah.
And I spent that entire episode on the edge of my seat worried that he was going to cheat on his wife.
This is an acceptable spoiler.
This is a spoiler. Okay. This is totally a spoiler.
But it's an acceptable 100%. One.
100%. I don't know how you could conceivably think this.
It's season one. Okay, fine, guys. But just quick thing on that. Like, that was obviously deliberate. Like, tell me about the decision making behind that.
So when I was saying the thing about sitting on the couch writing and how that is this incredibly free process, then you have to rewrite. And then you have to think about how it fits into the whole. So the whole gag is to write with total freedom and then rewrite with total clarity. And so when we're thinking about whether a character will behave in way A or way B, we're thinking about what they would do in the moment. And then we're thinking about the ramifications of that. So if the character did decision A, what does that then say about it, that character as we go through the rest of the series, which will leave us in a place where there's more optionality. And it's clear in that case, which one would leave us with more optionality.
That's great. Okay.
Oh, can I say one thing though? One of the great things about something like this is that someone like Mark can do the work he does and then I can do the work that I do. And if there's some sort of a mutual sort of fascination with the work, you get to connect with people on that. And that is one of the sort of unintended joys of the work that I get to do. And so that's why I was happy to fly out here and do this podcast because we've gotten to know each other over the last few years and it's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you so much for joining the A6NZ podcast, Brian, and for coming out here. We really appreciate it. And Billions, the next season is now out.
March 17th.
Thanks, Brian.
So happy to be here.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And by the way, people may not know, I actually play on the show. I actually play Wags under a rubber mask. And so that's why you never see me in a cameo.
I thought we weren't supposed to.
I'm sorry, everybody. Speaking of spoilers.
Oh my God, Wags is one of my favorite characters. Well, thank you.